Moralia questions Romani. Why do they command the bride to touch fire and water? Is it because these two, as elements and first principles, represent the one the male and the other the female, and the one introduces the principles of motion while the other supplies the power of the underlying substance and matter? Or is it because fire purifies and water cleanses, and the woman who has been married must remain pure and undefiled? Or is it that, just as fire without moisture is unnourished and dry, while water without heat is barren and inert, so too the male is powerless and the female powerless apart from each other, and it is their union that brings about, for those who marry, a shared life together? Or rather, is it that neither partner must be abandoned, and each must share every fortune with the other, even if the only things they are ever to share are fire and water? Why do they light not more, and not fewer, but 5 torches at weddings, torches which they call Kyrians? Is it, as Varro used to say, because 3 praetors were employed, and with the aediles more still, and it is from the aediles that those who marry take their fire? Or rather is it because, of the numbers in use, the odd number was thought better and more perfect for other purposes and also more fitting for marriage? For the even number admits division, and its equal parts are contentious and opposed to one another, whereas the odd number cannot be split apart completely but always leaves something over, being divided in common. And of the odd numbers the 5 is especially nuptial, for 3 is the first odd number and 2 the first even number, and from these, as it were from male and female, the number 5 is compounded. Or rather, is it because light is a sign of birth, and a woman by nature bears at most 5 children at a single birth, that they use that many torches? Or is it because they think that those who marry need 5 gods, Zeus Teleios, of fulfillment, and Hera Teleia, and Aphrodite, and Pytho, persuasion, and above all Artemis, whom women invoke in the pains and travails of childbirth? Why is it that, though there are many temples of Artemis in Rome, men do not enter only the one in the street called the Street of the Patrician? Is it on account of the story that is told, that a woman who was worshipping the goddess there was assaulted by a man and torn apart by dogs, and that ever since, out of the superstitious fear arising from this, men do not enter? Why is it that on the other temples of Artemis they commonly nail up the antlers of deer, but on the one on the Aventine, the horns of oxen? Is it in remembrance of the ancient event? For it is said that among the Sabines, a cow of surpassing appearance and size beyond all others was born to a man named Antron Coradius. And when a certain seer told him that it was fated that whoever should sacrifice that cow to Artemis on the Aventine would become greatest and would rule over the whole of Italy, the man came to Rome intending to sacrifice the cow. But a servant secretly disclosed the prophecy to King Servius, and Servius disclosed it to Cornelius the priest, and Cornelius instructed Antron to bathe before the sacrifice in the Tiber, since it was the custom for those making the sacrifice favorably to do so. Antron accordingly went off to bathe, but Servius, forestalling him, sacrificed the cow to the goddess and nailed its horns up in the temple. This story is related both by Juba and by Varro, except that Varro does not record the name of Antron, and says that the Sabine was tricked not by Cornelius the priest, but by the temple warden. Why is it that those who have been falsely reported to have died abroad, even if they return, are not received in through the door, but climb up onto the roof tile and are let down inside? Varro gives an entirely mythical explanation for this. He says that during the war in Sicily, after a great naval battle, a false report spread that many men had died, and that when these men returned home a short time later, they all in fact died soon afterward, except for one man, for whom, as he was entering, the doors met him closed of their own accord and would not yield however hard they tried to open them. This man, falling asleep before the doors, saw in his dreams a vision instructing him to be let down into the house over the roof. Having done this, he lived to a happy and prosperous old age, and from this the custom was established for those who came after. Consider, however, whether this custom in some way resembles Greek practice as well. For the Greeks did not consider such men pure, nor did they mix with them, nor allow them near sacred things, since a funeral procession and burial had already taken place for them as though they were dead. It is said that one of those affected by this superstition, Aristinus, sent to Delphi to beg the gods' help and to be released from the difficulties the law imposed on him. And the Pythia replied that whatever a woman undergoes in childbed when giving birth, he must undergo again, and then sacrifice to the blessed gods. So Aristinus, understanding the oracle, presented himself to the women as though he were newly born, to be washed and swaddled and given the breast, and did this, and so too did all the others afterward who were called those born again after their proper time. Some say, however, that this practice concerning such men existed even before Aristinus, and that the custom is an ancient one. It is therefore no wonder that the Romans too thought that men who were regarded as having already been buried once, and as belonging to the company of the dead, ought not to pass through the courtyard door, sacrificing as they go out and sacrificing as they come in, but were instead ordered to come down from above into the open air, out from under a roof. For indeed, they perform virtually all their rites of purification in the open air. Why do women kiss their male relatives on the mouth? Is it, as most people suppose, because it was forbidden for women to drink wine, so that if they had been drinking, they would not go unnoticed, but would be caught out by their relatives when they met them, and so the custom of kissing arose? Or is it for the reason that the philosopher Aristotle records? That much-told story, which is said to have happened in many places, seems indeed to have been dared also by the Trojan women in Italy. For when the men had put ashore, the women burned the ships, wanting above all to be free of their wandering and their fear of the sea. But fearing the men's anger, they greeted their relatives and kinsmen with kisses and embraces as they met them. And when the men's anger subsided and they were reconciled, the women continued ever after to use this same show of affection toward them. Or rather, was this given to the women as conferring both honor and a kind of power for them, if they could be seen to have many good relatives and kinsmen? Or was it that, since it was not the custom to marry blood relations, the show of affection extended only as far as a kiss, and this alone was left as a token and shared mark of kinship? For in earlier times, they did not marry those related by blood, just as even now they do not marry aunts or sisters. It was only later that they allowed marriage with cousins, and for the following reason. A man who was poor in money, but otherwise of good character, and well-liked by the people among all those active in politics, was thought to have married his cousin, an heiress, and to have grown wealthy from her. And when he was accused on this charge, the people, setting aside the need to prove the accusation, dismissed the charge, and voted that everyone should be permitted to marry as far as the degree of cousins, but that marriage with closer relations should remain forbidden. Why is it forbidden for a husband to accept a gift from his wife, and a wife from her husband? Is it, as Solon wrote, making gifts by the dying valid, unless someone is compelled by necessity or persuaded by a woman, thus excluding necessity as involving force, and pleasure as involving deception, that gifts between wives and husbands came to be viewed with similar suspicion? Or was it because they considered giving the poorest sign of goodwill, since even strangers give gifts, and people who are merely fond of one another, that they abolished this kind of currying favor from marriage, so that being loved and loving might be without price, freely given, and for its own sake and not for any other reason? Or was it because, since women corrupted by receiving gifts are especially prone to welcome strangers, it seemed a mark of dignity to love one's own without giving gifts? Or rather is it because a husband and wife's possessions ought to be held in common, husbands and wives alike? For the one who receives a gift learns to consider whatever is not given to be someone else's, so that by giving small things to each other, they would in effect be taking away the whole. Why is it forbidden for a bride and groom to accept a gift from a father-in-law or mother-in-law? Is it that from a father-in-law, so that the gift should not seem to pass to the wife by way of her husband's father? And from a mother-in-law, because it seemed just that one who does not give should not receive either? Why is it that, whether returning from the countryside or from abroad, men who have wives at home send word ahead to let them know they are coming? Is it because this is a mark of trusting that one's wife is doing nothing amiss, whereas to arrive suddenly and unexpectedly is like setting a trap and keeping watch on her? Or do they hurry to bring the good news of their arrival to wives who they suppose are longing for and expecting them? Or rather, is it that they themselves are eager to learn about their wives, whether they will find them safe at home and longing for them? Or is it that wives, in their husband's absence, are occupied with more household management and business, and with disputes and impulses directed at those within the household, so that the advance notice is given in order that, once free of these matters, she may offer her husband a welcome that is untroubled and pleasant? Why is it that when men worship the gods, they cover their heads, but when they meet with men who deserve honor, even if they happen to have their cloak over their head, they uncover it? This last fact seems to intensify that same puzzle. Now, if the story told about Aeneas is true, that when Diomedes was passing by, he covered his head and completed the sacrifice. This makes sense, and it follows that covering oneself before enemies goes along with uncovering oneself when meeting friends and good men. For the practice toward the gods is not distinctive in itself, but a matter of coincidence, and it has persisted as an observance from that time on. But if some other explanation must be given, consider that one need not seek only why men cover their heads when worshiping the gods, the other practice follows from it. For men uncover their heads before those more powerful than themselves, not so as to add to their honor, but rather to take away their envy, so that they may not seem to be demanding the same honors as the gods, nor to tolerate or take pleasure in being served in the same way as the gods. And they used to worship the gods in this fashion, either humbling themselves by covering the head, or rather, being wary lest some ill-omened and inauspicious sound from outside should fall upon them as they prayed, they drew the cloak up over their ears. For that they guarded strictly against this is clear from the fact that those who approach for divination surround themselves with the clashing noise of bronze vessels. Or, as Castor says, associating Roman practice with Pythagorean teaching, the divine spirit within us has need of the gods outside and supplicates them. And by the covering of the head hints at the enclosure and separation of the soul by the body. Why do they sacrifice to Saturn with the head uncovered? Is it because Aeneas handed down the practice of covering the head, while the sacrifice to Saturn is far more ancient? Or is it that men cover their heads before the heavenly gods, while they consider Saturn a god of the underworld and the earth? Or is it that nothing of truth is hidden or overshadowed, and the Romans believe Saturn to be the father of truth? Why do they consider Saturn the father of truth? Is it, as some philosophers hold, that they think Saturn to be time, and time discovers what is true? Or is it that the life mythically ascribed to the age of Saturn, if it was indeed most just, is likely to have had the greatest share of truth? Why do they also sacrifice to the god called Honos with the head uncovered? Honos being a name one might translate as reputation or honor. Is it because reputation is bright and conspicuous and open to view, and for the same reason that they uncover their heads before good men who are honored, they also worship in this manner the god named for that same honor? Why is it that at funerals sons carry out their parents with heads covered, while daughters do so with heads bare and hair unbound? Is it that fathers ought to be honored by their sons as gods, but mourned by their daughters as the dead, the law thereby assigning to each what is proper, and, from the two together, producing what is fitting? Or is it that what belongs to mourning is what is not customary, and it is more customary for women to go out in public with heads covered, and for men with heads uncovered? For among the Greeks, too, when some misfortune occurs, the women cut their hair while the men let it grow long, because for the one sex cutting the hair and for the other letting it grow is the custom. Or was it thought fitting that sons should cover their heads for the reason already given? For indeed at tombs, as Varro says, men turn themselves about, honoring their fathers' monuments as they would sacred shrines of the gods, and after cremating their parents, as soon as they come upon a bone, they say that the dead one has become a god, while women were not permitted to cover their heads at all. It is recorded, at any rate, that the first man to divorce his wife was Spurius Carvilius, on the grounds of childlessness. The second was Sulpicius Gallus, who saw his wife drawing her cloak up over her head, and the third was Publius Sempronius, who divorced his wife for watching a funeral games. Why is it that, though they regard Terminus, to whom they celebrate the Terminalia, as a god, they used to sacrifice no living creature to him. Is it because Romulus set no boundaries for the territory, so that it should be possible to advance and to seize land and consider as one's own whatever spear could reach, as the Spartans said? Whereas Numa Pompilius, a just man, a statesman, and one who had become a philosopher, marked out the land in relation to their neighbors, and having assigned the name Terminus to the boundaries as an overseer and guardian of friendship and peace, thought it right to keep him pure and undefiled by blood and slaughter. Why is the shrine of Leucothea forbidden to slave women, while the women who bring in a single one strike and slap her on the cheek? Is it that this woman's being struck is a token symbol of the fact that others are not permitted to enter, while the others are kept out on account of the myth? For it is said that Ino, out of jealousy over a slave woman on account of her husband, was driven mad in her fury against her own son. And the Greeks say the slave woman was Aetolian by birth and was called Antiphera. This is why, among us too, at Chaeronea, before the shrine of Leucothea, the temple warden takes up a whip and proclaims, "Let no male slave enter, nor female slave, no Aetolian man nor Aetolian woman." Why is it that at the shrine of this goddess, they do not pray for good things for their own children, but for those of their sisters? Is it that Ino was fond of her sister and nursed her sister's child, while she herself was unfortunate in regard to her own children? Or is it, quite apart from this, that the custom is a moral and admirable one, one that produces much goodwill among kinsfolk? Why did many of the wealthy dedicate a tenth of their property to Heracles? Is it because Heracles too, in Rome, offered up a tenth of the cattle of Geryon in sacrifice, or because he freed the Romans when they were being made to pay a tenth to the Etruscans? Or is it rather that these explanations do not have reliable historical basis? Or was it because to gluttonous, hearty-eating Hercules they sacrificed lavishly and without stint? Or rather because, curbing wealth that had grown burdensome to their fellow citizens, excising it, as it were, the way an athlete at the peak of condition is trimmed back? They believed that this was the way Hercules was most honored, and that he delighted in such curtailments and reductions of excess, since he himself had lived a frugal, self-sufficient, unostentatious life. Why do they reckon the month of January as the beginning of the new year? In old times, in fact, March used to be counted first, as is clear from many other proofs, and especially from the fact that the fifth month from March is called the fifth, and the sixth, and so on for the rest in order down to the last, which they call December, being reckoned the tenth from March. From this some have come to suppose, and to say that the Romans of that time completed the year not with 12 months, but with 10, adding to some of the months more than 30 days. Others record that December was the 10th month from March, January the 11th, and February the 12th, in which month they perform purifications and offer rites to the dead, since the year is ending. They say that these months were transposed, and January made first because on the new moon of this month, the day they call the Calends of January, the first consuls were installed, once the kings had been expelled. But more plausible are those who say that Romulus, being warlike and battle-mad, and reputed to be born of Ares, set March, which bears the name of Ares, before the other months. While Numa, who was in turn a man of peace and eager to turn the city toward the works of the earth and away from war, gave the leading place to January and advanced Janus to great honors, since Janus had become a figure of civic and agricultural rather than military character. Consider, though, whether it was not rather Numa who, by nature, took the beginning of the year that is most fitting for us. For in general nothing that revolves in a circle is by nature either last or first. It is by convention that different peoples take different points as the beginning of time. But best of all are those who take as the beginning the time after the winter solstice, when the sun, having ceased advancing further away, turns and comes back again toward us. For then it happens for them, in a way, even by nature, that the time of light is increased for us and the time of darkness diminished, and the ruling and guiding power of all fluid substance is brought nearer. Why, when the women adorn the shrine of the goddess called the Good Goddess, do they not bring myrtle into the house, although they are eager to use all growing and flowering things? Was it, as the mythographers relate, because she was the wife of Faunus the seer, and having secretly indulged in wine and not escaping detection, she was beaten by her husband with rods of myrtle, And so they do not bring in myrtle, but pour libations of wine to her, calling it milk. Or is it rather that they perform that rite in a state of purity from many things, but especially from sexual intercourse? For they not only send the men out of the house, but drive out every male creature, whenever they perform the observances ordained for the goddess. They therefore keep away myrtle as sacred to Aphrodite, for indeed the goddess they now call Venus Myrtia was, it seems, anciently named Maetia. Why do the Latins hold the woodpecker in reverence, and why do all of them strictly abstain from harming this bird? Was it because they say that Picus, transformed by his wife's drugs, changed his nature, and becoming a woodpecker, uttered oracles and gave responses to those who consulted him? But this tale is altogether incredible and monstrous. The other story is more plausible, that when Romulus and Remus were exposed, not only did a she-wolf offer them the teat, but also a woodpecker used to visit and feed them with morsels of food. For even now, it is generally true that in mountainous and wooded places wherever a woodpecker appears, a wolf appears there too, as Nigidius records. Or rather, is it that, just as one bird is sacred to one god and another to another, this bird too is held sacred to Ares, since it is bold and high-spirited, and its beak is so strong that it can overturn oaks, when in pecking it reaches the core? Why do they suppose that Janus came to have two faces, and so depict and mold him? Was it because by birth he was a Greek, from Perhebia, as they relate, and having crossed over into Italy and settled among the barbarians there, he changed both his tongue and his manner of living? Or rather was it because he took the people around Italy, who lived by wild and lawless customs, and transformed and refashioned them into another pattern of life, persuading them to till the soil and to live under civic order? Why do they sell the equipment for burials within the precinct of Libitina, holding Libitina to be Venus? Was this too one of the philosophical devices of King Numa, so that people might learn not to be distressed by such things nor to shun them as pollution? Or rather is it a reminder that whatever is born is perishable, since it is a single goddess who oversees both births and deaths? For indeed at Delphi there is a small statue of Aphrodite of the tomb, before which they call up the departed for their libations. Why do they have three fixed beginnings and set dates in the month, not taking the same interval of days between them? Was it, as those around Juba relate, because on the Calends the magistrates used to summon the people and announce the nones for the fifth day, while they regarded the Ides as a sacred day? Or rather was it because, marking time by the phases of the moon, they observed that the moon undergoes, in the course of a month, three principal changes. The first when it is hidden, having come into conjunction with the sun. The second when, escaping the sun's rays, it first becomes visible in the west. And the third, which concerns its fullness, when the moon becomes full. They call its disappearance and concealment the Calends, since everything hidden and secret is clam and celer means to be concealed, and they call the first appearance the nones, by the most fitting of names, since it is a new moon, for they too, like us, call what is new and fresh by that term. And the Ides they name either from the beauty and the appearance, species, the moon presents when it is restored to fullness, or in giving that appellation in honor of Jupiter. One should not, however, chase after the most precise count of days, nor quibble over slight discrepancies, since even now, with astronomy having made such advances, the irregularity of the moon's motion still eludes exact calculation, escaping the mathematician's most careful observation. Why do they set aside as unsuitable for setting out or traveling abroad the day after the Calends, the Nones, and the Ides? Was it, as most people suppose and as Livy records, because after the Ides of Quintiles, which they now call the Ides of July, the military tribunes led the army out and were defeated in battle by the Celts near the river Allia and lost the city, and once the day after the Ides had come to be regarded as inauspicious, custom, as superstition is wont to do, carried the practice further and extended the same scruple to the day after the Nones and the day after the Calends as well? Or does this explanation involve many inconsistencies? For it was on a different day that they suffered the defeat, the day which they call the day of Allia after the river, and which they hold in abhorrence for that reason. And though there are many inauspicious days, they do not observe the corresponding days in every month, but only the particular day on which the event fell. And to extend the scruple, without qualification, to all the days after the Knowns and the Kalins alike is quite implausible. Consider, then, whether it is not rather this. Just as of the months they consecrated the first to the Olympian gods and the second to the gods of the underworld, in which month, too, they perform certain purifications and offer rites to the departed, so too of the days they set apart the first, as it were, the principal and governing days, three in number, as has been said, as festal and sacred, while the days that follow them they assign to the spirits of the dead and to the departed, and regarded as inauspicious and unfit for business. Indeed, the Greeks, too, in honoring the gods at the new moon, assign the second day to heroes and spirits, and the second mixing bowl is poured out for heroes and heroines. And altogether, time is a kind of number, and the beginning of number is divine, for the unit is such a beginning. The dyad that comes after it is opposed to that beginning and is the first of the even numbers. And the even is deficient, incomplete, and indeterminate, just as, in turn, the odd is bounded, brings completion, and is perfect. That is why the Knowns fall on the fifth day after the Kalins, and the Ides on the ninth day after the Knowns, for it is the odd numbers that mark the beginnings, whereas the numbers that come right after the beginnings, being even, have no rank or power, and hence people do not begin an undertaking or a journey on those days. Or there is also something in the story about Themistocles, that the day after a festival once quarreled with the festival day itself, complaining that the festival had much business and toil, while the day after offered leisure and quiet to enjoy the things prepared for the festival. And that the festival replied to this, "What you say is true, but if I had not existed, you would not exist either." This is what Themistocles used to say later to the generals of the Athenians, that they would have been nowhere had he not himself saved the city. Since then, every journey and undertaking worth taking seriously requires management and preparation, and since the Romans of old, during their festivals, managed and thought about nothing else, but were occupied only with matters concerning the gods and busied themselves with that alone. Just as even now the priests, on their way to the sacrifices, make proclamation beforehand. It stands to reason that they did not immediately set out on journeys after the festivals, nor undertake business. For they were unprepared. Instead, they spent that day at home thinking things through and making their preparations. Or, just as even now, after praying and doing reverence in the temples, people are accustomed to linger and sit a while, so too they did not immediately follow their sacred days with days of active business, but made some pause and interval, since many affairs bring difficulties and unwelcome complications. Why do women wear white clothing and white headbands in mourning? Was it, as they say the Magi do, opposing themselves to Hades and to darkness, and so making themselves resemble what is bright and radiant, that they do this? Or is it rather that, just as they clothe the body of the deceased in white, they think it fitting that the relatives should do likewise? They adorn the body in this way since they cannot adorn the soul, but they wish to send off the soul bright and pure, as one now released and having fought through a great and varied contest to the end. Or is it that plainness and simplicity are especially fitting in these circumstances, whereas dyed garments show either extravagance or overelaborate artifice? For it is no less true of black than of purple to say, "Deceitful are the garments, deceitful the colors." Whereas black in its natural, undyed state is colored not by art but by nature, and being mixed with shadow, it has been overcome by it. White alone, then, is pure and unmixed, unstained and inimitable by dye. It is therefore most fitting for the dead. For the deceased, too, has become something simple, unmixed, and utterly pure, having been released from the body, which is the source of dye that stains. In Argos, however, they wear white in mourning that has been washed in water, as Socrates says. Why do they consider every wall sacred and inviolable, but not consider the gate so? Was it, as Varro wrote, that the wall must be held sacred, so that men might fight for it eagerly and be willing to die for it? For it is in this light that Romulus is thought to have killed his brother, on the ground that he was attempting to leap over an impassable, sacred spot, and to make it passable and profane. As for the gates, it was not possible to consecrate them, since through them many necessities pass, and also the dead are carried out through them. Hence those who found a city from the beginning, whenever they are about to build up a site, plow around it with a plow, yoking together a male and a female ox. And when they mark out the walls, they lift the plowshare where the gates are to be, measuring off those spaces, and so carry the plow across, so that the entire ground that is plowed will be sacred and inviolable. Why, when boys swear an oath by Hercules, do they forbid them to do this under a roof, and bid them go out into the open air? Was it, as some say, because they believe that Hercules does not delight in staying indoors, but in an outdoor life and living under the open sky? Or rather was it because this god is not a native one, but comes from afar, a stranger? For indeed they do not swear by Dionysus under a roof either, since he too is a stranger, if indeed he is Dionysus. Or is this said and done in play with the boys, while in truth it is a way of restraining the readiness and quickness with which people rush into an oath, as Favorinus used to say? For the delay, coming as it were from a kind of preparation, produces hesitation and allows time to deliberate. One might also support Favorinus by pointing out that this practice is peculiar to this god and not common, on the basis of what is said about Hercules. For it is recorded that he was so scrupulous about oaths that he swore only once, and that only to Phyleus, the son of Augeas. And it is for this reason that the Pythia used to cite these oaths to the Lacedaemonians, as men who kept faith, saying, "It would be better and more advantageous." Why do they not allow the bride to step over the threshold of the house herself, but those escorting her lift her over it? Was it because the first women too were carried in that way, having been seized by force, and did not enter of their own accord? Or do they wish it to appear that the brides enter under compulsion and not willingly, since they are about to have their virginity dissolved? Or is it a symbol that she is not to go out through it herself nor to leave the house, unless compelled, just as she entered it under compulsion? For indeed among us in Boeotia they burn the axle of the wagon before the door, signifying that the bride must remain, since the means of taking her away has been destroyed. Why, when they bring in the bride, do they instruct her to say, "Where you are Gaius, I am Gaia"? Was it that, as though under stated terms, she immediately enters upon sharing in everything and joint rule with him, the meaning being, "Where you are lord and master of the house, there I too am lady and mistress of the house"? Or do they use these names in another sense, since they are common names, just as the jurists use Gaius Seius and Lucius Titius, and the philosophers use Dio and Theon? Or is it because of Gaia Caecilia, a beautiful and virtuous woman who lived with one of the sons of Tarquin, whose bronze statue stands in the temple of Sancus? There used also to lie beside it in olden times sandals and a spindle, the one a symbol of her keeping house, the other of her industry. Why is the much celebrated song sung, "Talasius, at weddings"? Is it from Talasia, woolworking, for they also call the basket a talasos, and when they bring in the bride, they spread a fleece under her, and she herself brings in a distaff and spindle, and wreathes the door of the bridegroom's house with wool? Or is what the historians say true, that there was a certain young man, brilliant in war and excellent in other ways, named Talasius? And when the Romans were seizing the daughters of the Sabines who had come to watch the games, a maiden of striking beauty was being carried off for Talasius by some of the common people and his own clients, who shouted for her safety, and that no one should approach or lay hold of the girl, since she was being carried off as a wife for Talasius. So the rest, honoring Talasius and joining in the good wishes and acclamations, followed and escorted her along. And from this, since the marriage turned out fortunate, people became accustomed to cry out Talasius at other weddings too, just as the Greeks cry Hymenaeus. Why, at the full moon of May, do they throw effigies of men from the wooden bridge into the river, calling the things thrown Arge? Is it that in ancient times, the barbarians who dwelt about that place used to destroy in this way any Greeks they captured? But Heracles, admired by them, put an end to the killing of strangers, and taught them the custom of imitating that superstitious practice by throwing effigies instead. And the ancients called all Greeks alike Argives, unless, by Zeus, one supposes that the Arcadians, because of their proximity, regarded the Argives too as enemies, and that the followers of Evander, who had fled from Greece and settled there, kept up the old grudge and hostility. Why did they not, in old times, dine out apart from their sons, while these were still boys? Is it that Lycurgus too instituted this practice, bringing the boys into the public messes, so that they might grow accustomed not to approach their pleasures like wild animals or without discipline, but with due caution, having their elders as overseers and spectators, as it were? And this practice made the fathers themselves no less restrained and self-controlled in the presence of their sons. For where old men behave shamelessly, as Plato says, there the young are bound to be most shameless of all. Why, when the rest of the Romans make libations and offerings to the dead in the month of February, did Decimus Brutus, as Cicero has recorded, do this in December? This was the man who overran Lusitania and was the first to lead an army across the river of forgetfulness. Is it, just as most people are accustomed to make offerings to the dead as the day ends and the month wanes, reasonable also that, as the year comes to its close, the dead should be honored in the last month, and December is the last of the months? Or is it that honors are due to the gods of the underworld, and it is timely to honor the powers below once all the crops have been gathered in? Or is it that when men break the earth to begin sowing, it is especially fitting to remember those below? Or is it that this month has been consecrated by the Romans to Saturn, and they hold Saturn to be one of the gods below, not of the gods above? Or is it that, since the greatest of their festivals, the Saturnalia, falls in this month, and seems to bring the most gatherings and enjoyments, they thought it right to set apart some of these first fruits also for the dead? Or is it simply false that Brutus alone made offerings in this month? For indeed they perform the rite for Laurentia too, and bring libations to her tomb, in the month of December. Why do they honor Laurentia so, though she had been a courtesan? They say there was another Laurentia, called Acca, the nurse of Romulus, whom they honor in the month of April. But the courtesan Laurentia, they say, had the surname Fabula, and became known for the following reason. A certain temple attendant of Heracles, enjoying leisure as it seems, was in the habit of spending most of his days at draughts and dice. And once, when none of his usual companions happened to be present to play with him and share the pastime, in his frustration he challenged the god to cast dice against him as if on stated terms. If he won, he was to obtain some benefit from the god. But if he lost, he himself was to provide the god with a dinner and a beautiful girl to spend the night with him. On these terms he set out the dice, cast one for himself and one for the god, and lost. So, abiding by his own challenge, he prepared a splendid table for the god, and taking Laurentia, who was openly a courtesan, he feasted her and laid her to rest in the temple, and on leaving he shut the doors. It is said that in the night the god came to her, not in human fashion, and bade her go at dawn to the marketplace, and whomever she should meet first, to attach herself to him especially and make him her friend. So Laurentia rose and went, and met one of the wealthy men, unmarried and past his prime, named Terudius. Becoming known to him, she ruled his household while he lived and inherited it when he died. And later, when she herself died in the course of time, she left her estate to the city, for which reason she is accorded these honors. Why do they call a certain gate a window, Thyrus? For this is what Fenestra signifies, and beside it stands the so-called Chamber of Fortune. Is it because King Servius, who was most fortunate, gained the reputation of being visited by Fortune, who came to him through a window? Or is this a myth, and the truth rather that, when King Tarquinius Priscus died, his wife Tanaquil, a woman of sense and royal bearing, leaned out through a window, addressed the citizens, and persuaded them to proclaim Servius king, and so the place received this name? Why is it customary, of all the things dedicated to the gods, to allow only spoils of war to be disregarded as time wears them away, neither doing them reverence nor repairing them? Is it so that people, supposing the glory to fade along with the earliest trophies, may always seek to bring some fresh memorial of their valor? Or rather, because as time dims the marks of the quarrel with the enemy, it would be invidious and provocative of hostility for men to renew and refurbish them themselves? For among the Greeks, too, those who first set up a trophy of stone or bronze do not win approval. Why did Quintus Metellus, when he became chief priest, a man otherwise reputed prudent and skilled in public affairs, forbid the taking of auspices after the month of Sextiles, now called August? Is it that, just as we undertake such business when the day is at its height or just beginning, and when the month is waxing and increasing, but avoid the waning days as unfit for business, so likewise the period 8 months into the year is to be reckoned like a kind of evening of the year, a late afternoon already declining and waning? Or is it also that one must use birds that are in their prime and full grown? These are such before summer, but around autumn, some are weak and sickly, Some are still fledglings and immature, and others have vanished altogether, migrating because of the season. Why was it not permitted to those who were not on active campaign, but were merely present about the camp in some other capacity, to strike or wound an enemy soldier? This too Cato the Elder made clear in a certain letter, writing to his son and bidding him, if he had been discharged from the campaign after completing his term of service, to return home, or else, if he remained, to obtain from the general permission to wound and kill an enemy. Is it that necessity alone ought to be the warrant for killing a man, and one who does this without law or command is a murderer? For which reason Cyrus praised Chrysantas, because, though about to kill an enemy and with his sword already raised, on hearing the recall sounded he let the man go and did not strike him, as being now forbidden. Or is it that one who is engaged with the enemy and fighting, should he show cowardice, ought not to go unaccountable or unpunished? For a man does not help his side so much by striking and wounding someone as he harms it by fleeing and retreating. So he who has been discharged from service is released from the laws of the soldier. But he who has asked to be allowed to act as though still serving has once again made himself accountable to the law and to the general. Why is the priest of Jupiter not permitted to anoint himself in the open air? Is it that it was neither holy nor decent for sons to be seen naked by their father, or a son-in-law by his father-in-law, and in old times men did not even bathe together with one another? And Jupiter is the father, and the open air seems, in a way, to be especially in the presence of Jupiter. Or is it that, just as it is forbidden to strip oneself naked in a temple or sanctuary, so they were careful to show the same reverence for the open air beneath the sky, which is likewise full of gods and spirits, for which reason we perform most of our necessary functions under a roof, concealing and covering ourselves within our houses out of respect for the divine? Or is it that some things are enjoined by law upon the priest alone, and others upon everyone through the priest? Thus among us too, the wearing of a garland, the growing of the hair, the not carrying iron, and the not stepping across the borders of the Phocians are duties peculiar to the Archon. But the not tasting of the autumn fruit before the autumnal equinox, nor pruning the vine before the spring equinox, is thereby made known to virtually everyone through the Archon, for each is the proper season for that person. In the same way, it seems, it is peculiar to the priest among the Romans neither to ride a horse, nor to be away from home more than 3 nights, nor to lay aside the cap from which he is even called flamen. But many other things are made known to all through the priest, and one of these is the not anointing oneself in the open air. For the Romans were greatly suspicious of dry anointing, and they think that nothing has been so much a cause of slavery and softness among the Greeks as the gymnasia and wrestling schools, which breed much idleness and leisure in their cities, and mischief born of leisure and pederasty, and the ruin of the young men's bodies through sleep, walks, rhythmic movements, and strict regimens, through which they were unwittingly drained away from arms, and content, instead of being good hoplites and horsemen, to be called witty fellows and fine wrestlers. At any rate, this is a thing men manage to avoid by stripping in the open air, but those who anoint themselves at home and attend to their bodies there do nothing wrong. Why did the old coinage on one side bear the two-faced image of Janus, and on the other the stern or prow of a ship engraved upon it? Is it, as most say, in honor of Saturn, who crossed over to Italy by ship, though this could be said of many, for Janus, Evander, and Aeneas too all arrived by sea? Rather, one might conjecture this, that some things are honorable for cities, others necessary, and the greatest of the honorable things is good order, and of the necessary things, abundance of supply. Since then, Janus established good order for them by civilizing their way of life, while the river, being navigable and bringing down goods both from the sea and from the countryside, supplies abundance of necessities. The coin bore as its symbol the two-faced image of the lawgiver, as has been said, on account of the change he brought, and the fairy image of the river. They also used another coinage, bearing the device of an ox, a sheep, and a pig, since they derived their wealth chiefly from their livestock and had their property from these, for which reason many of the names among the ancients were Suilius, Bubulcus, and Porcius, as Fenestella has recorded. Why do they use the temple of Saturn as a treasury for the public funds, and at the same time as a repository for contracts? Is it that the belief and tradition prevailed that there was no greed or injustice among men while Saturn reigned, but only good faith and justice? Or is it that the god presides over the excellence of crops, or of husbandry? For this is what the sickle signifies, and not, as Antimachus wrote, following Hesiod, that shaggy Saturn, cutting sideways with the sickle, was fashioned in requital against the genitals of his father Uranus, son of Acmon. Rather, abundance and disposal of crops is the origin of coined money, and so they make the god both the cause and the guardian of prosperity. This is confirmed by the fact that the gatherings held every ninth day for the market, called Nundini, are held sacred to Saturn, for it was the surplus from selling and buying crops that gave rise to the beginning of commerce. Or are these things ancient, while the first man to make the temple of Saturn a treasury, after the kings were overthrown, was Valerius Publicola, who believed the place well fortified, conspicuous, and hard to plot against? And why do envoys arriving at Rome from wherever they come, on going to the temple of Saturn, register their names with the prefects of the treasury? Is it because Saturn was once a stranger, and therefore delights in strangers? Or is this too resolved by history? For it seems that in old times, the questors used to send gifts of hospitality to envoys. The things sent were called lotia, and they took care of them when sick and buried them at public expense when they died. But now, because of the great number of envoys arriving, the practice of such expenditure has lapsed, though the custom of applying first to the prefects of the treasury by registering still remains. Why is the priest of Jupiter not permitted to take an oath? Is it that an oath is a kind of test applied to freemen, whereas the body and soul of the priest ought to be beyond all testing? Or is it that it is not fitting for a man entrusted with the greatest and most sacred matters to be distrusted in small ones? Or is it that every oath ends in a curse upon the perjurer, and a curse is an ill-omened and grim thing, for which reason it is not thought right for priests to curse others either? At any rate, the priestess at Athens was praised for refusing to curse Alcibiades, though the people ordered her to do so, for she said she had become a priestess of prayer, not of cursing. Or is it that the danger of perjury is a common one, if an impious and perjured man should be the one to begin the prayers and sacred rites on behalf of the city? Why, at the festival of the Veneralia, do they pour out much wine from the sanctuary of Venus? Is it, as most say, that Mezentius, general of the Etruscans, sent word to Aeneas offering a truce in exchange for receiving the year's wine? And when Aeneas refused, Mezentius promised the Etruscans that, if victorious in battle, he would give them the wine. But Aeneas, learning of his promise, consecrated the wine to the gods, and after his victory gathered in the harvest and poured it out before the sanctuary of Venus. Or is this too a symbol that one ought to celebrate festivals sober rather than drunk, since the gods take more pleasure in those who pour out their strong wine than in those who drink it? Why did the ancients keep the temple of Horta continually open? Is it, as Antistius Labio has recorded, that since to urge on is called Hortari? They thought that the goddess called Horta, who as it were exhorts and urges men on toward what is honorable, ought, as being always active, never to be thought of as delaying, nor shut up, nor idle. Or rather, as they now call her Hora, with the first syllable lengthened, a watchful and much caring goddess, whom they believed, since she was protective and thoughtful, was never careless or heedless of human affairs. Or, like many other such words, is this too one of the Greek names, and does it signify a goddess who watches over and oversees? Hence, as one unsleeping and unwearied, her shrine was open at all times. If, however, Labio is right in supposing that Hora is named from urging on, then consider whether one ought to say that the orator, an exhortatory and urging kind of counselor or popular leader, was named accordingly, and not from cursing and praying, as some say. Why did Romulus establish the temple of Hephaestus outside the city? Was it because of the jealousy fabled between Ares and Hephaestus over Aphrodite, since Romulus was thought to be the son of Ares, that he did not make Hephaestus his fellow resident or fellow citizen? Or is this too foolish an explanation, and rather the temple was built from the start as a private council chamber and meeting place for himself and Tatius, his co-king, so that they might gather there with the elders and, without being disturbed, deliberate on affairs in peace? Or, since Rome from early on was in danger from fire, did they decide to honor the god but settle him outside the city? Why, at the festival of the Consualia, do they crown both horses and donkeys with garlands and let them rest from work? Is it because they hold the festival for Poseidon Hippios, and the donkey shares in the horse's enjoyment and partakes of the immunity from work? Or is it because, once seafaring and transport by sea had appeared, the beasts of burden gained some measure of relief and rest? Why was it the custom, as Cato records, for those announcing their candidacy for office to do so wearing only a cloak, without a tunic? Was it so that they should not bribe voters by carrying money concealed in a fold of the tunic? Or rather because they used to judge those worthy to rule not by birth, nor wealth, nor reputation, but by wounds and scars? So that these might be visible to those they met, they went down to their canvassing without tunics. Or, just as by greeting people, calling to them, and bowing before them, so too by this nakedness they humbled themselves and courted the people's favor. Why did the priest of Jupiter, when his wife died, lay down his office, as Attius records? Was it because a man who had lost the wife he had taken was worse off than one who had never married at all? For the household of a man who has married is complete, while that of one who has married and then lost his wife is not merely incomplete, but maimed. Or is it that the wife shares the priesthood with the husband, since many of the sacred rites cannot be performed without his wife being present, and to marry another immediately after losing the first was neither easily possible nor otherwise seemly? For this reason, it was not formerly permitted for him even to divorce her, nor, it seems, is it permitted even now, though in our own time Domitian, on being petitioned, granted an exception. The priests attended the dissolution of the marriage, performing many rites that were dreadful, strange, and grim. One might marvel at this less if one recalls also that, when one of the censors died, the other was required to give up his office as well. And when the censor Livius Drusus died, his colleague Aemilius Scaurus refused to resign his office, until some of the tribunes of the people ordered him to be led off to prison. Why do the Lares, whom they specifically call priestites, have a dog standing beside them, while the Lares themselves are clothed in dogskins? Is it that the priestites are those set over something, and it is fitting for those set over a household to be watchful guardians of it, fearsome to outsiders, as a dog is, but gentle and mild toward those who dwell within? Or rather is what some of the Romans say true, that, just as the philosophers of Chrysippus' school suppose that base spirits roam about, whom the gods employ as executioners and punishers against unholy and unjust men, so too the Lares are a kind of avenging, punitive spirits, overseers of lives and households. And this is why they are clothed in dog skins, and a dog sits beside them, since dogs are formidable at tracking down and pursuing wrongdoers. Why do they sacrifice a dog to the goddess called Geneta Mana, and pray that none of the household born may turn out virtuous? Is it because Geneta is a spirit concerned with births and childbirth among mortal things, for her name signifies a kind of flowing, or birth, or flowing birth? Just as the Greeks sacrifice a dog to Hecate, so the Romans sacrifice a dog to Geneta on behalf of those born in the household. Socrates says that the Argives likewise sacrifice a dog to Ilionia because of the ease it brings to childbirth. As for the prayer itself, is it perhaps not about household-born humans that none of them turn out virtuous, but about dogs, since dogs need to be fierce and fearsome? Or, hinting darkly at the fact that the dead are politely called the good, do they through this prayer ask that none of the household die? One need not be astonished at this, for Aristotle too says that in the Treaty of the Arcadians with the Spartans it was written that none of the Tegeans loyal to Sparta should be made good for the sake of assistance, meaning that none should be put to death. Why, at the Capitoline Games, do they still now proclaim Sardians for sale, and lead forth, for mockery, some old man wearing a child's amulet called a bulla around his neck? Is it because the people called the Veients, Etruscans, waged war against Romulus for a long time, and this was the last city he captured, and he sold off many prisoners along with their king, mocking his stupidity and foolishness? And since the Etruscans were originally Lydians, and the mother city of the Lydians is Sardis, they proclaimed the Veients for sale in this manner, and preserve the custom to this day as a kind of game. Why do they call butcher shops Maesella and Makelli? Is the name corrupted from Madras, cook, as many other words have been, and has usage prevailed, for kappa and gamma are related among them, since they came late to using the letter gamma, which Spurius Carvilius introduced. And lambda in turn stands in for those who slip on the letter rho through a slurring of the tongue, or must this too be resolved by the historical account? For it is said that in Rome a violent, robber-like man, who had plundered many people, named Maecilus, was with difficulty caught and punished, and from his confiscated property a public building was constructed, taking its name from him. Why is it granted to flute players, on the Ides of January, to go about the city wearing women's clothing? Is it for the reason commonly given? For it seems they enjoyed great honors, granted to them by King Numa because of their sanctity in matters of the divine. But later, when these honors were taken from them by the proconsular board of 10, they withdrew from the city. There was then a search for them, and a certain religious scruple troubled the priests, since the sacrifices were being offered without flute music. Since they would not be persuaded to return when summoned, but remained at Tibur, a freedman secretly promised the magistrates that he would bring them back. Having prepared a lavish feast, as if he had made a sacrifice to the gods, he invited the flute players. Women, too, were present along with the drinking, and an all-night revel was got up, with games and dancing. Then suddenly the man threw in the claim that his patron was coming upon him, and, feigning distress, persuaded the flute players to climb onto wagons covered all around with hides, to be carried off to Tibur. But this was a deception, for he drove the wagons around, and, since they could not tell what was happening because of the wine and the darkness, he brought them all unnoticed into Rome by dawn. Most of them, because of the all-night revel and the drinking, happened to be wearing brightly colored, womanish clothing. So, once they had been persuaded by the magistrates and reconciled, it became the custom that on that day they should parade through the city dressed in this fashion. Why do the matrons seem to have founded the shrine of Carmenta from the beginning, and to honor it most especially even now? A certain story is told that the women were forbidden by the Senate to use yoked carriages, so they agreed among themselves not to conceive or bear children, in retaliation against the men, until the men changed their minds and granted them their wish. And once children had been born, being blessed with good and many children, they founded the shrine of Carmenta. As for Carmenta, some say she was the mother of Evander, called originally Themis, or, as others say, Nicostrata, who came to Italy, and because she sang oracles in verse was called Carmenta by the Latins, for they call verses Carmina. Others hold that Carmenta is fate herself, and that this is why the matrons sacrifice to her. The etymology of the name is deprived of mind, because of her states of divine possession. Hence it was not the Carmina that gave Carmenta her name, but rather she was called by that name because, in her ecstatic possession, she sang her oracles in verse and meter. Why, when sacrificing to Rumina, do they pour a libation of milk and do not bring wine? Is it because the Latins call the nipple Ruma, and she is said to have been named Ruminales, since the she-wolf offered her nipple to Romulus? Just as we call women who nurse infants with milk nurses, the Lanae from nipple, Thiel, so Rumina, being a kind of nurse and rearer of children, does not accept unmixed wine, since it is harmful to infants. Why did they address some senators as the enrolled fathers and others simply as fathers? Is it because they called those originally chosen by Romulus fathers and patricians, as being well-born, able to name their own fathers, while those later enrolled from the plebeians they named enrolled fathers? Why was there a common altar of Hercules and the Muses? Is it because Hercules taught letters to the followers of Evander, as Juba records? And the matter was regarded as a solemn one, teaching being done for friends and relatives. Only later did they begin to teach for pay, and the first to open a school for letters was Spurius Carvilius, a freedman of the Carvilius who was the first to divorce his wife. Why, when there are two altars of Hercules, do women not partake or taste of what is sacrificed on the greater one? Is it because those concerned with the rites of Carmenta arrived late, and the family of the Pinarii was also late, and so, being excluded from the feast while the others banqueted, they were named Pinarii? Or is it on account of the myths told about the tunic and Deianira? Why is it forbidden to speak of, seek out, or name that god, whether male or female, whose special charge it is to save and guard Rome, and why do they wrap this prohibition in superstitious dread, recounting how Valerius Soranus perished miserably for having revealed it. Is it, as some Roman writers have recorded, that there are such things as the summoning out and bewitching away of gods, by which they believed that they themselves had once drawn certain gods away from their enemies and settled them among themselves, and they feared suffering the same thing at the hands of others? Just as the Tyrians are said to have bound their images with chains, and others are said to demand sureties when sending a god forth to a bath or a purification, so the Romans thought that the unspoken and unknown was the safest and surest guard of a god. Or, just as it is put in Homer, the earth is still common to all, so that all men might revere and honor all the gods, holding the earth as common possession, so did the ancient Romans conceal the identity of the one in charge of their safety, wishing that not only this god, but all the gods be honored by their citizens. Why, among those called the Fesials in Greek, something like peacemakers or treaty bearers, was the one called Pater Patratus held to be the greatest. This is the man whose father is living and who has children of his own, and even now he retains a certain privilege and trust, for the praetors entrust to such men bodies that, on account of their beauty and youthful charm, require careful and chaste guarding. Is it because such men possess both the reverence children have and the fear owed to fathers? Or does the very name suggest the reason? For Patratus is meant to signify one who is, so to speak, brought to completion and made whole, as being more perfect than others, in that he has come to have a son while his own father is still living. Or must the one presiding over oaths and peace look both ahead and behind, as Homer says? And such a man would be especially fit for this who has a son on whose behalf he deliberates and a father with whom he deliberates. Why is it forbidden for the one called Rex Sacrorum, this is the king of the sacred rites, both to hold office and to address the people? Is it because in ancient times the kings performed most and the greatest of the sacred rites themselves, and offered the sacrifices along with the priests? But since they did not act with moderation, but were arrogant and oppressive, most of the Greeks took away their power but left them only the office of sacrificing to the gods, while the Romans expelled their kings altogether and appointed another to attend to the sacrifices, allowing him neither to hold office nor to court popular favor, so that they might seem to be ruled as kings only in matters of religion, and might tolerate kingship for the sake of the gods. There is, at any rate, a certain ancestral sacrifice performed in the forum near the place called the Comitium, after which the king performs it and departs quickly, fleeing from the forum. Why did they not allow the table to be cleared while still bare, but always insisted that something remain upon it? Is it a hint that one should always leave something from the present for the future and remember tomorrow even while in today? Or did they consider it refined to restrain and hold back desire even while enjoyment was still present? For people who have grown accustomed to abstaining from what is present desire, what is absent less? Or is the custom also one of kindness toward household slaves? For they are not so pleased by receiving as by sharing, feeling in some sense that they partake of their master's table. Or is it that nothing sacred should ever be seen left empty, and the table is sacred? Why does the husband not first approach his bride by daylight, but rather in darkness? Is it because he feels shame before consummation, regarding her still as a stranger, or because he is being accustomed to approach even his own wife with modesty? Or, just as Solon wrote that the bride should nibble a quince before entering the bridal chamber, so that the first kiss might not be unpleasant or graceless, so too did the Roman lawgiver, if there were anything unseemly or displeasing about her body, conceal it? Or is what happens rather a kind of veiled reproach against unlawful acts of love, implying that even lawful ones carry with them some measure of shame? Why is one of the race courses called the Flaminian? Is it because a certain Flaminius of old gave land to the city, and they used the revenues from it for horse races, and since money was still left over, they built a road, which they likewise named the Flaminian Way? Why do they call the rod-bearers lictors? Is it because these men used to bind up wrongdoers and attended upon Romulus carrying thongs in the folds of their garments, for most Romans call binding allegare, while those who are careful in their speech say ligare? Or is it rather that the kappa has now been inserted, and formerly they were called litters, being a kind of public servants, for that the public treasury is to this day called laton, in many of the laws of the Greeks has, one might say, escaped no one's notice, Why do the Lupercai sacrifice a dog? The Lupercai are those who run naked, gird about the loins, through the Lupercalia, striking with strips of leather those they meet. Is it because the rite performed is a purification of the city? For indeed they call the month February, and by Zeus that day Februata and February means to touch with strips of leather, the word signifying to purify.